Good afternoon and welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. A trainer at a domestic violence workshop I once attended told me that one of the most dangerous things a woman can do in her lifetime is to get married. Domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women in the U.S., more than car accidents, muggings, and rapes combined. Every day, more than three women are killed by their husbands or boyfriend, and 33% of all female homicide victims were killed by a current or former intimate partner. Domestic violence can happen to anyone, regardless of race, age, sexual orientation, religion, or gender, and it affects people of all socioeconomic backgrounds and education levels. Domestic violence not only affects those who are abused, it also has a significant impact on family members, friends, coworkers, and society as a whole. Children who grow up witnessing domestic violence are among those most severely affected. Frequent exposure to anger and violence in the home not only predisposes children to numerous social and physical problems, but it also increases their risk of becoming the next generation of victims and abusers. Joining me today to discuss the issue of domestic violence is the Deputy Director of Abused Women's Aid in Crisis, otherwise known as AWAKE, Melissa Emmel. Melissa is a lifelong Alaskan who has over 10 years of experience working with victims of interpersonal violence. She is currently the Deputy Director at AWAKE, Alaska's largest provider of domestic violence safe shelter and intervention services. She's responsible for overseeing all AWAKE programs, including an Alaska Native Safe Home, a transitional housing program, case management and financial assistance programs, court-based legal advocacy, community education and prevention, volunteers, a children's program, and an emergency shelter. She has provided interpersonal violence training to professionals throughout Alaska, as well as nationally and internationally. I want to thank you, Melissa, for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to remind listeners of Line One that Dr. Woodard will continue to host Line One three times a month, and I will continue to bring you a monthly show focused on emotional health and wellness. If you have any questions for today's guest or want to share some information or tips on today's topic, you can reach us in several ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last one is by way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. And you got to spell all that out. That's line one. All right, Melissa, again, thanks for being here. I guess we should start off by having you tell us, that was quite a mouthful on the introduction,
right?
About stuff, the stuff that you do and oversee. I don't know, I'm not sure how you have time to do all that. Maybe you have other people helping.
I do. We have lots of people helping.
So what is your, what's your role over there? How long, I guess you've been there 10 years, but what kind of things are you working on?
I've been there 10 years, and I oversee all of the programs in terms of supervising the managers and the frontline staff. AWAKE has almost 50 staff members, and we're a 24-hour agency. So 24 hours a day, we're available for support and to help people who may be in an abusive situation. One thing I'll mention is we do have a 24-hour number, and I always like to start out by making it available to people who might be listening.
Yeah, please.
It's 907-272-0100, and people are there 24 hours a day to take calls if you're in an unsafe situation or if you're just a concerned family or friend and need some advice on how to help somebody that you know who may be getting hurt.
That number was, one more time?
907-272-0100.
Okay, and we'll mention that again at the end. So people, if you have paper and want to write that stuff down. All right, so the programs that AWAKE offers, sister agencies, I guess for lack of a better term, or other agency that you work closely with in dealing with domestic violence, sexual abuse, child abuse, all that stuff. What kind of things are you guys working on currently?
Right. Well, our core service is our emergency shelter. It's our sort of main program. It's the first program that we started. And that's basically a safe refuge for people who have to flee abusive situations. It's somewhere where women and children can come to get away from someone who's hurting them. It's important to know that we also do serve men off-site separately and not in our main shelter.
Okay.
We're located in downtown Anchorage in a very public location. We're on the corner of 13th and A. And we did that purposefully. The history of the domestic violence movement movement was sort of hidden safe houses that were difficult to find and really didn't speak to the important public nature of this issue. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be something that has silence around it. And so when we built this new facility in 1983, we wanted to say, we're here, we're public, this is an issue that everyone should know where to get resources.
Okay, what other organizations or agencies do you guys coordinate with?
We work very closely with Standing Together Against Rape. That's the Rape Crisis Center here in Anchorage.
STAR program?
STAR.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They also operate a 24-hour crisis line, and they serve people who have experienced sexual assault, ranging from children all the way to adults. We work very, very closely with them in terms of providing shelter to sexual assault victims if that's needed, but also just working together because the issues of domestic violence and sexual assault are very intertwined in terms of root causes and community response.
Yeah, they are very much linked. All right, so I guess for the purposes of today's discussion, domestic violence and doing the research for the show, I've found it is a huge umbrella.
Giant.
So for the purposes of our discussion today, I read things about intimate partner violence, domestic abuse, family abuse, child abuse, spousal abuse. It goes on and on. That's just to name a few. Is domestic violence an umbrella for all of those, or is it something different?
It is an umbrella for all of those. When we think about domestic violence, sort of the core piece of it is there has to be a relationship between the two parties. So that could be a spousal relationship or a family relationship. For example, elder abuse, that's a family member maybe hurting an older family member. Or child abuse, that's generally a family member or someone very close to the family hurting a child. Mm-hmm. It could even be roommates. The key is that there has to be a relationship there for it to be domestic violence. And again, there's many different types of abuse, ranging from emotional to physical, financial, spiritual. And on, seemingly.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of the different types of abuse. So it's anything having to do with, I guess as the name implies, domestic,
mm-hmm.
right?
Exactly.
I'm trying to keep up. Domestic violence, so anything that has to do with in-home. You mentioned roommates. It could be a roommate mm-hmm. situation.
The legal definition encompasses roommates or anybody that you've ever lived with or even past partners. For the purposes of our discussion and also who we often see the most at Awake, it's generally intimate partner violence. So that's really when one person in a relationship makes a choice to use physical, verbal, emotional, financial, sort of any different abusive tactic to gain and maintain power and control over their partner.
So that includes manipulation, mm-hmm. bank account, controlling, that sort of stuff.
Exactly.
So I think domestic violence is really misunderstood in public for the layperson who's not, in the counseling business or in the domestic violence business. What are some things about domestic violence that people might not know or that they might go, huh, that's interesting?
Yeah. I think people who haven't experienced it or haven't been closely involved or worked with it professionally may oversimplify the issue and think, why doesn't the victim just leave the relationships? It's simple. Just break up. Just leave. And that choice to leave is never a simple choice. And there's lots of reasons, including fear of safety and love and sort of dependence financially that may make that decision really, really complicated. But again, I think people have this perception like, victims must be weak or stupid or they must like the way that their relationship is or they would just leave. And that's not the case.
All right. So there is one of the myths about domestic violence one of the big ones that I've heard is that it doesn't happen to men.
Absolutely. We hear that a lot. And oftentimes campaigns for awareness are a picture of a woman with a bruise or of women and kids that look neglected or sad. And abuse happens to men, I think, at rates that we don't even understand because it's very underreported for both men and women. People are afraid to talk about this issue. They're not reporting it, regardless of your gender. And abuse definitely happens to men. It happens to male children. It happens to adult men in both heterosexual and homosexual relationships. The services at Awake are available to men.
All right. So what are some other things that we might not know about domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse? it seems like it's pretty common knowledge, but then there's all sorts of subtle things that I think people miss.
I think a big misconception that people have is that domestic violence is caused by alcohol, drugs, anger, mental illness, things like that. Those are huge myths. And so often as a society, we try to tackle those things to end violence. For example, we may associate domestic violence with alcohol, and so we send someone to rehab hoping that their, you know, lifetime of learned behavior to isolate and control and abuse their partners will go away, and that won't work. They're separate issues, and certainly some of those things can exacerbate an already bad situation, but at its base, domestic violence is a learned behavior. It's a behavior that's often learned in childhood, in your family of origin, but it's also something that is just learned in society. We live in a violent world, and violence is reinforced in many ways through the media, culture, and because it works to get control over your partner.
You said it's not about anger, it's not about drugs, it's not about alcohol. Those are, you called them...
Misconceptions.
Misconceptions. Mm-hmm. Isn't it true, though, that alcohol does play a part? I mean, in a high number of domestic violent incidents.
Absolutely, it's true. There's a correlation. So they happen together a lot. And certainly if you take a relationship where there's violence and power and control issues and you add alcohol to the mix, either on the part of the victim who may be using it to cope with the trauma,
right,
or on the part of the abuser, it's a recipe to make a bad situation worse. But the important thing to understand is it's not the cause. If you take that alcohol away, those learned abusive behaviors will still be there and need to be addressed separately.
Okay, so it's not, if somebody is not abusive and they drink, they're not going to become, that's what you're saying, there has
right.
to be a predisposition or a tendency towards that.
Exactly, and it's so important to understand that because abusers like to excuse away their behavior. They like to blame it on the victim, or they like to find something else that's the cause of it. So they can say, oh, I was just drunk. I normally wouldn't hurt you. And then the victim, this can also impact her safety if she thinks, oh, if he quits drinking or limits drinking, then I'm safe. And that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I had a client a while ago, a couple that he only became angry when he drank what she called white liquor. So as long as he stuck to beer, it wasn't a problem. So that was her goal for therapy, was to get him mm-hmm. to stick to beer.
Yeah. And, you know, I can understand why people and victims have that perception, because it seems worse when the person's drunk.
Right.
So it makes sense. And I don't think it's productive to maybe argue with someone in the situation about that. But as a society, for how we address this issue, we need to be addressing those root learned behaviors and not just alcohol or drugs.
It sounds like it's bigger than just intervening with the individual.
Absolutely.
Okay. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Melissa Emmel, Deputy Director of AWAKE. We are discussing the impact of domestic violence on our children, families, and community. I want to remind listeners that you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433. You can call 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is by emailing your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. We touched briefly on the different types of domestic violence, but can you just run them down for me again real quick? What is included in that umbrella?
We often see emotional, physical, spiritual, sexual, or financial abuse. Those are kind of broad categories. Really, it can be any behavior that is aimed at getting power and control over another person that's unwanted. Abuse is really a problem of crossing someone's boundaries in order to get power and control. And it can look like a lot of different things. It can look like intentionally isolating someone from their support system, intimidating them either through physical force or just by the threat of physical force.
Right.
It can be minimizing and denying that the abuse even happens, blaming abusive behaviors on the victim. Using children as pawns is very common in abusive relationships, where the abuser may threaten that if you leave me, I'll take the kids. And that can be a very realistic threat in terms of how things work out in a separation or divorce. So really, there's just this whole range of behaviors. And it's important to note that the physical abuse is often very scary and part of it, but it's really the emotional aspects of power and control that keep people trapped and are often the hardest to deal with long term.
I'm glad you said that. Matt, what makes the emotional abuse so insidious and difficult to break free of? It seems like it's oftentimes, as you just mentioned, more difficult than violent relationships. If somebody's going to the hospital a bunch of times, there's police intervention and families involved, there's a really good reason that that person should be leaving. But this emotional stuff is sneaky.
It's sneaky. And the thing about emotional abuse is that it makes a person feel unworthy. Emotional abuse is aimed at damaging someone's self-esteem and making them feel like they can't survive without you. And when you think that you can't do something on your own, you're much more likely to stay and feel trapped. When I think of all of the women that I've talked with over the years, that's a theme that has reoccurred, is that, you know, the emotional abuse and the damage to sort of their character and their soul is what has made getting safe and getting out the most difficult. And a big part of emotional abuse I want to note is blame. Abusers will do something abusive and then blame their victim. It could be something simple like dinner wasn't ready when they got home from work. And so they say, you know, if you had just done what I asked, I wouldn't have had to abuse you. And if you think about someone who's isolated from their support system, not talking to friends and family about what's going on, and so their only way that their worldview is shaped is really that abuser's narrative. You're not worthy. It's your fault that this is happening. You're not worthy. It's your fault. It's your fault. People begin to internalize that narrative, and they really, really believe it. For someone who hasn't experienced abuse, it may be hard to understand because it doesn't really make sense from the outside. But from the inside, that victim feels truly like it's her fault. And if you think a problem is your fault, you spend time trying to fix it by fixing yourself. So victims often spend years and years and years stuck in this cycle of trying to make things perfect. So the next night, dinner's on the table.
Right.
Or they try to make themselves prettier or lose weight or parent more effectively or whatever it is. The problem is that doesn't work because abusers keep changing their expectations. They're unrealistic and ever-changing. So the next night, dinner's on the table, and he may say, "Why do you bother me when I first walk in the door? You know, I just need to relax when I get off work." So it's always changing and always unrealistic and very, very difficult.
You expect me to just come home and eat?
Exactly.
Like right when I walk in, give me 10 minutes.
And that kind of dynamic is really crazy making for someone.
Right.
They begin to think, you know, am I not hearing things right? How can I stop this? What can I do to make myself better so the abuse stops?
So the problem then is that this emotional, it's manipulation. It's making you feel like you're the problem as the victim. It very much the isolating from, I mean, because the abuser doesn't want you talking to your friends and family about your life and what's happening.
Right.
You don't talk to your friends at a dinner party. Well, you know, no. Bob beat me up last night. And
no, exactly. You know, I had a friend who just got out of a marriage that was about 14 years long that was, you know, very controlling and only got physically abusive towards the end. But what I saw from the outside was a person who loved social occasions, would come to parties, would talk to everybody.
Right.
Turn into someone who turned down every invitation, said no to family gatherings, and wasn't telling any of her support system, "I can't go because I'm not allowed." But that was the real reason. The real reason was that if she did go, it would turn into a big violent fight with accusations of cheating or accusations of, you know, if you love me, why do you need to spend time with other people? And so people tend to try to avoid that blow up by doing what they're told. And that doesn't necessarily work because, again, that expectation may change.
And plus, there's so much shame involved with domestic violence.
If you think something's your fault, you're often ashamed of it if you can't solve it. That makes a lot of sense. If you really believe it's you that's causing it and you can't make it stop and it's hurting your kids and it's hurting you, yeah, I mean, tons of shame. It's a reason why people don't tell anybody.
Which makes it really difficult to deal with. It seems like a lot like addiction. I mean, you mentioned somebody that hasn't been in an abusive relationship and under that power and control by somebody else who maybe they've lived with for 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's so sneaky, insidious, and slow sometimes,
right.
Just like alcoholism or drug dependency. that the person in it can't really see it. Is that what
Absolutely.
You're saying?
From the outside, you think, I would never let myself be abused. If someone hurt me, I would walk away. But abusers don't punch someone on the first date. They are very charming and very quick to shower someone with lots of attention and affection. Yeah. They often may be sort of choosing someone who already has a past of victimization or damaged self-esteem. And they really exhibit a ton of loving behaviors, very quick involvement. And so really, abusive relationships and healthy relationships can often look the same at the very beginning in terms of, I want to spend all my time with this person. I love them. And then slowly that isolation begins to happen, but it's disguised as flattery. I just want to spend a lot of time with you. I love you so much. You know, you don't really need to go see your friends and family when you could be spending time with me. And that happens in healthy relationships, too, where people spend a lot of time together at the front. So it can be very, very difficult to spot. And someone may be pregnant, married, moved in, very well solidified in a relationship before they really begin to notice the signs or before any type of sort of overtly abusive behavior happens.
Yeah, because not many people would tolerate that on like date two, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, you treated me like crap on date two, so yeah. Let's go back for date three.
No,
it's everybody sends their best representative. So what you're saying is that it really is those two, a healthy relationship and a future abusive relationship will look the same.
They will, and that's why it's difficult for people to notice and to spot those warning signs. But really, if you kind of analyze the beginning of a relationship later on, people can often pick out boundary violations or intentional isolation. But in that moment when they have all of those charged emotions and they're feeling loved and connected, it's so easy not to spot. It's so easy to feel flattered and excited and, you know, all of those positive feelings you feel at the beginning of a relationship.
I have an email which kind of goes along with this. It says, please, can you discuss the difference between a bad, quote unquote, bad relationship with manipulation versus one that involves domestic violence? It says, I get concerned that the term domestic violence is overused and therefore trivialized. So I think what this person is trying to ask is, In a relationship, there can be manipulations and there can be underhanded. I mean, everybody's relationship isn't healthy, but that doesn't necessarily make it violent or domestic violence is what this person's asking.
Right. Well, I think it depends on what you're looking at. If you were looking at what's the legal definition of domestic violence, there's a lot of things that, in my opinion, are very damaging and unhealthy and abusive that are perfectly legal to do.
Checking somebody's phone.
Right. Checking someone's phone. Extreme jealousy and possession that borders on controlling somebody's actions. All of those things are abusive. And I think that, you know, people often might have that idea that, oh, it's just an unhealthy relationship. It's not abuse. But I think anything aimed at controlling another person and using unhealthy abusive tactics to do it is domestic violence, is abuse. And it's a really slippery slope because you might think, well, this isn't abuse. This is just, you know, we need to work on our communication. But when you look sort of long-term, abusive behaviors tend to get worse and more extreme over time. They have to get more extreme to maintain control for that long of someone. And so the end result can be, you know, serious injury and death. And so what I challenge people to do is to try to spot those signs early on. And if it's about power and control and if it's about sort of keeping you, controlled in your daily activities, then you should look at whether or not it's crossing your boundaries and it's abusive.
So then the difference between the bad relationship with manipulation and one that involves domestic violence, it doesn't sound like there is a difference.
Well, in my opinion, an abusive behavior is an abusive behavior. If you're doing something intentionally to gain and maintain control over your partner, yes, and you're using unhealthy tactics to do it, that's abuse. And of course, there's different degrees of abuse. Punching someone is a lot different than checking their phone and monitoring who they talk to, but they're on a continuum of the same type of thing, and they're aimed at the same result. So, you know, in my opinion, it's all abusive behavior.
So it is like autistic spectrum disorder. Like there is a spectrum of domestic violence. And as you said, it starts out really slow, and because you can't just come out and dump all this power and control on somebody. It starts simple.
Right.
It starts small
and it gets worse over time. And that continuum of each relationship is different. So there may be some relationships that never have physical abuse, but they're still extremely damaging to the victim and the children in the home. They, you know, damage self-esteem and self-worth and sort of independence. And
I have quite a few men that have shown up in my office over the years and have said, well, you know, my dad used to beat me and my mom, mm-hmm. and I've never hit my family. So mm-hmm. I'm not abusive.
Right.
But they punch holes in doors. They intimidate through, you know, their size and their physicality. They get in people's face. They call names. Mm-hmm. They do really feel like they have made a massive improvement.
Right. And yeah, I would agree. It's an improved behavior to not punch someone and punch the wall next to them. But the message is the same, right? If I punch a wall in the room that you're in, it means your face is the next thing I could punch. And you should feel equally scared right now in the second while I'm hitting the wall as you would if I was actually hitting you.
That's designed to intimidate, correct?
It's designed to intimidate and control.
And to demonstrate power.
And to demonstrate power, yep, exactly. And so to me, you know, what's better or worse, it's the same result, a person who is now controlled and living in fear.
All right. That is, it's interesting. So this next question I'm going to ask is for, like, really personal reasons. And I'm interested to hear your response, because I have three young girls. They are
handful.
3, 5, and 8. Yeah. And they are not far out from beginning the dating thing and going out with boys named.
How old are they?
They're 3, 5, and 8.
Okay. So they really are not far out. Sometimes people ask that question and they tell me they have a 12-year-old and I'm like, sorry, it's already here.
Yeah. No, the 8-year-old thinks she's 12, but she's not quite there. So, I read that nearly 1 in 5 teenage girls who have been in a relationship said that a boyfriend threatened violence or self-harm if presented with a breakup. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you the number of times I hear that in my office from 15, 16-year-old mm-hmm. girls and boys, too, that their partner's going, I mean, their boyfriend or girlfriend's going to kill themselves. I'm going to cut myself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to run away. How do we talk to our daughters about this stuff ahead of time so that they will know that it's not okay. It's never okay.
Right. Well, I think an important thing is to live by example, right? So, like I said, domestic violence is a learned behavior, and people learn the patterns that they'll ultimately realize in their relationships, often in their family of origin, and by what they're exposed to in terms of the relationships that they see in friends' families and in the media, etc. So, to the extent you can, live a healthy and positive relationship yourself to show that to your kids, I think, is the base level thing that's so, so important. And then I would say it's never too early to start talking about what's healthy and what's not healthy in relationships, and talking to kids about being able to set boundaries for themselves and ways to stand up for themselves if those boundaries are being crossed is very, very important. And that should start young with friendships. You know, if you look at a second, third grader, how are they interacting with their friends? What do they do if bullying happens? Do they know safe adults? A thing that really protects kids from ultimately being damaged by abusive relationships is having a strong connection to their community, knowing safe adults to talk to, and then having someone talk to them and explicitly teach them what is healthy and what is safe in a relationship. We don't do that enough. We don't open up that line of communication because it feels awkward, or we've sort of been conditioned not to talk about it. But it's just like teaching someone anything else, like how to tie their shoes or math. You have to say, this is what's healthy and this is what's not. And if something else is happening, you know, especially if you're a parent who already suspects that your teen is in one of these relationships, really approaching the conversation with as much non-judgment as possible and not sort of throwing out an ultimatum that you have to break up or you can't see him, you know, or else. Because I think that usually has a backfire effect.
That drives them right into their arms.
And that's true for teenagers and for adults. You know, if you tell your friend you're concerned about their relationship, and then the next thing you say is, if you don't break up with them, then I don't want to see you until you do.
Yeah.
Then you've just further isolated them, and you've taken away a resource that might really help them get safe later.
Okay, I think this is a good time for us to, we are at the 30-minute period, so we're going to go ahead and take our break. I want to remind folks that you are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we will continue our conversation with our guests, Melissa Emmel. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. In case you're just joining us, my guest today is Melissa Emmel, Deputy Director of AWAKE, and our topic is domestic violence. I want to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to bring you a variety of health information on Line 1, Your Health Connection, 3 Mondays every month, and I'll continue to host a monthly show on mental health, mental and emotional health. You can email questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. Call 550-8433 locally or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. Before the break, Melissa, you mentioned modeling, which I seem to bring up on this show a lot, is because I talk a lot about teenagers and kids, and so modeling seems to be the most important factor in getting what you want out of your children. So with that in mind, you mentioned girls who come from homes where modeling is abusive or violent or manipulative or controlling. Girls and boys, they have a tendency to grow up and have a predisposition to get involved in those or a higher risk. So of the people involved in adult relationships that are abusive, how many of them what's the percentage that come from homes where there's some emotional or physical abuse going on?
I think that it's a very high percentage, probably more than 80% of people that, you know, have a past history of victimization of some sort. I want to say, though, that it's not a prescription that you will grow up and definitely have abusive relationships if you experienced either witnessing abuse or actually direct physical or sexual abuse as a child. That doesn't mean that you have to be an abuser or you have to be in a victim as an adult. You can learn different ways. And I've talked to just as many people who've experienced abuse as a child who've said, because that happened to me, I made a choice to learn how to be healthy and to learn other behaviors and to, you know, sort of take a stand that I'm not going to have that be a part of my life, either as a victim or as an abuser. They went the opposite way. And it's difficult because, you know, a lifetime of learning how relationships work and watching a pattern over and over and over becomes very ingrained in you. And so it can take some work and some real thought to get away from that pattern. But it's possible, and anybody can do it. It's really important that people don't feel a sense of hopelessness around this issue.
I've always said that if you grow up in a certain environment, and then you realize as an adult that it was unhealthy, you're sort of fighting against your nature,
right?
In some way, because you've been scripted and like taught, trained to react. I mean, it's your norm, right?
Yeah, it's your norm. And until you learn something different, you may not know. I've talked to many, many women who didn't realize some of the things they were experiencing were abuse because they had been such a part of their childhood, such a part of what they'd always witnessed, that it didn't occur to them that there was any other way. And that's how child abuse victims often feel, or child witnesses to DV often feel. You only know what your family's doing, for the most part.
Yeah, because so it's a very tiny world.
Right. Your family's chaotic. They're screaming. There's yelling. It's mom's fault that dad's upset, or vice versa. That's what you think is normal. And it's really hard to teach somebody differently than that, than sort of what their family of origin is teaching them. But it's possible. And I think the more that we can do in schools and in sort of public campaigns, the better, because people need other influences than, again, that small world of their family.
I've worked with a lot of people who have said that they didn't realize that there was anything wrong with their family until they went to a friend's house in junior high.
Right. Yeah. And they saw, like, nobody was screaming and somebody spilled the milk and, you know, it wasn't a big scene. And
everybody said, oops.
Wow. Oops. Yeah. No biggie. You only know what you know. And
got another email that says, you talk about physical and verbal abuse in very black and white terms. Example, one person in a relationship is abusive. What about if both individuals are abusive, both verbally and physically in a relationship? How do you help when you suspect both people are physically or verbally aggressive and abusive and contributing to the problem? So this is a question that I expected would happen. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a two-way street is what this person's saying, right?
Well, I think that if you look at a behavior on its own and you just look at that moment in time or that behavior, of course, people can, in either a victim of abuse or somebody who you would typically say is an abuser can make a choice to, you know, use intimidation or a threat or manipulation, or they can yell or, you know, on and on. But when we think about domestic violence and we think about the point of it, which is to really gain and maintain power and control, most of the time in a relationship, there is one person whose behaviors are aimed at doing that. Are specifically aimed at controlling the other person, and often there's one person who's actually very physically afraid of the other person. And so that's kind of often where the line is. I would say that humans are complex and relationships are complex, and yeah, it's not a black and white issue, but most of the time when you really sort of get down to the root of things, there's often, in these types of situations, one person who's kind of the primary aggressor or the primary abusive person, and that's often the one who has the power and control in the situation.
Now, it sounds like people who are involved in those, I mean, first of all, they don't really always know that they're in an abusive relationship. They don't think, right, of it that way. I had one lady tell me, oh, I give it as good as I get.
Yeah.
But then over time, we realized that most of hers was defensive in nature, or in order to thwart some sort of meanness, she got mean back. It was more retaliatory.
Right. And so she probably wasn't the one in that situation that had the true power and control. I've heard many times victims tell me that when they think about the cycle in their relationship, which may be, you know, a period of things are really great, there's this honeymoon, and then there's a phase where tension is building, and there's sort of this vying for power and control that's happening. I've had victims tell me, I do something on purpose to make the abuse just happen because I'm so sick of that anxious, walking on eggshells feeling.
Sort of get it out of the way.
Right. Where I know it's coming. And so maybe I'll just, specifically not do what I know he's wanting me to do in that moment. Or I'll sort of talk back, et cetera, just to make the explosion happen, make the abuse happen. Because what usually happens after a big abusive incident, uh-huh, in these types of relationships is it goes back to that honeymoon phase where there's an apology and an I'm sorry and a period of relative calm. And so sometimes people may do something on purpose to get it out of the way, because that walking on eggshells, anxious feeling is awful.
So you're talking about this. Are you talking now about the cycle of violence?
Yeah. There often relationships
it's a good time
have
to go
a predictable.
Into that.
Mm-hmm.
If you could sort of outline what that is, and because you talked about the it blows up, it gets bad, and then there's a dormant time or a downtime, things are calm.
Yeah, and not every relationship follows that exact pattern, but generally if you think about the beginning of a healthy or an unhealthy relationship, there's that quick involvement, the honeymoon, the intense feelings. And then as the abusive person is trying to get that power and control, there's tension in the relationship where there's sort of this jockeying for control. The person maybe is trying to isolate you or trying to control your daily activities. And so there's tension where this tension is building. Eventually, an abusive incident will happen. And we call that the explosion phase, basically, where abuse erupts. And then after that, there can be a period of calm that can almost feel like that honeymoon again with, you know, the I'm sorries and the don't leave me and this will never happen again. Always peppered with a little bit of blame, though, where it's also, if you hadn't done that, this wouldn't have happened. It's your fault, but I love you. And it can go on in that sort of cyclical pattern. And eventually, that honeymoon period may kind of go away because once someone is very, very tightly controlled, you have to do less to keep them controlled.
Gotcha. We have, right now, I'd like to go to the phones. We have Karen, you're on with Melissa Immel.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to make a comment. I'm really happy that you have talked about a continuum of domestic violence, and you know, it does, it's pretty rare for it to start off, you know, enraged, like especially like you were talking about the second date.
Right.
Yeah. Charming. Yeah. Very charming. So I am speaking from personal experience. Okay. Charming until I was married and in college and didn't, you know, so it starts off slow. You know, you said it starts off slowly, but, you know, what does that mean? Well, there's a line of that you cross, and there are several lines that can be crossed, and you know, yeah, yelling, name calling, maybe kicking a cupboard door in a rental house, breaking a hole in the door, and then not even saying sorry, but the next morning. The reason was that dinner wasn't on the table. Okay, you know, classic reason.
Right.
And the next morning, the cupboard door was repaired, painted, nothing said about it. And, you know, a woman might be afraid to say something.
Certainly being afraid to say something.
3-year-old or 2-year-old, actually. So, and those things, and so, yeah, the honeymoon period didn't happen for a long time, birthday, German chocolate cake, okay, and then it starts happening, you know, it happens again, a long time. So that kind of thing. And the blame the victim, I lost custody of my 2 little girls because I cried. And the judge said, yes, domestic violence has been committed on this woman. But, you know, look at him. He looks very mild-mannered, and he was. He is very mild-mannered in company. But I cried because it was so emotional, and it was so emotionally draining and so scary because I wasn't living with him at the time, but he got full custody of 2 little girls, and this abuse escalated to throwing heavy ceramic objects at me in front of a little girl of my second daughter, and the spoon, the wooden spoons fell on her face as she tried to run and hug me.
Karen, I want to just thank you so much for
specific things. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to thank you for sharing part of your story. I know that it can be a really difficult thing to do, but I think people speaking up about their experiences helps us to get rid of some of the silence around this issue, which is the only way we'll combat it. I also wanted to highlight something you said about custody of your girls. And again, I'm so sorry to hear that part of your story, but I think it can help others to understand that one of the reasons why people stay in abusive situations is because they're worried if they get separated that the other party will get the kids. And your story really highlights that that's a possibility and that does happen. And so sometimes people are staying because they think, okay, well, at least if I'm here and we're all together in the house, I can know what's happening with the kids and protect the kids to the best of my ability. And that can just be a big reason why people have difficulty making the choice to leave. So thank you. I think everything that you said is really brave and important and will certainly help others that are listening.
Yeah, may I add just one quick little thing? In the trial for custody, the judge blamed me for going. I went to the awake shelter before it was where it's in the location where it is now. And this has happened in late 80s. Okay? And the judge blamed me for taking my children with me to the awake shelter.
Yeah, and you know, especially during that period of time, there were a lot fewer laws protecting victims, and much more silence even than now about the issue. So I can only imagine the difficulties that you faced and the bravery that it must have taken for you to leave that situation. So again, thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you, Karen,
thank you
for calling in. I appreciate you sharing your story, and I think it highlights what Melissa's been talking about, and what I was hoping to do by bringing the show on is to really look at some of the plight that people have who are your example's a classic example of some of the stuff that went on for a long time, and hopefully the courts are more knowledgeable, and with people like Melissa and Awake and fighting for victims' rights, hopefully that is less of a problem now than it was. Is that true, Melissa? You started to touch on that.
I think it's still a big problem. If you look at often the abusive party may have no criminal record. There may be no, quote, proof the abuse happened. Maybe the police were never called. Hospitals were never visited. So there's not much to take to court in terms of legitimizing abuse. And the abusive person may have more access to financial resources to pay for an attorney. It can be very, very complex.
Is it a common occurrence? I mean, because like we've talked about, there's this veil of shame and secrecy around domestic violence. And a lot of times I have women come in and say, well, you know, now he's fighting me in court for custody. He's been beating me for 10 years, but there's no record. There's no paper trail of any arrests, and it's just he said, she said.
That's often the case because it's such an underreported crime.
Yes.
There's often no sort of paper trail. So what we encourage people to do is to think about if there's a safe way for them to document abuse that happens on a calendar that they keep at work or in a journal that they keep at a friend's house, if that's doable. Or, you know, making reports to Awake or another agency, or visiting your doctor's office and during your annual exam, disclosing that to them. Because, again, if you do get to the place 10 years from now where you're thinking, okay, I'm ready to leave, and there's a custody battle, it may be very difficult to prove abuse has happened if there's been no disclosure or record keeping on your part.
Is it helpful for women or men, if they're being abused? I mean, the secrecy keeps it, you know, in the closet, so to speak, mm-hmm. and empowers the abuser. So if a person is telling their family and their friends and bringing it to light, is that actually a good thing and gives the couple hope or opportunity?
I think that it is a good thing in theory, but I think that it has to be done very carefully and with a lot of thought for safety.
Right.
The most dangerous time in a relationship is when the abuser believes the victim is thinking about leaving, planning to leave, or after they've just left. And disclosure of, hey, abuse is happening to your sister, if it gets back to the abusive person, they may take that as a sign you're thinking about leaving, and they may escalate the abuse to keep that power and control. When we look at violent abusive incidents, homicides, suicides, those often happen at that leaving stage. And so I just caution people, if you are thinking about leaving or disclosing to others, do that very, very planfully with a safety plan in place. And Awake can help someone sit down and talk about options for safety. And I think it's very critical to do that before making plans to leave.
Safety is so important. You got to have a plan.
Have to have a plan.
And that's what you guys can help do.
Yeah, that's what we can help do. And every situation is different. And victims often, 100% of the time, are the best equipped to know what will escalate their abuser. For example, for one person, going down to the courthouse and getting a protective order may be a really great tool for safety. And for another person, they may know that if their abuser served with court paperwork, he's going to come and try to find them and hurt them. And so it's very, very gray in terms of every situation is different. And planning very, very carefully and having lots of options and backup plan A, B, and C is super important.
I want to talk briefly or quick, you know, I guess fairly briefly about, because we could go on all day, but How does witnessing domestic violence impact small children? Can you just touch briefly on what the impact is with the kids? Because I had a woman in my office, and she was talking to me one day about her boyfriend who was living there, and he was doing this and doing that, and she was making all these excuses every time I said, well, why would you let him treat you that way or what? And she kept going. Finally, I said, what would you do if your 15-year-old daughter was being treated that way by somebody? And she started to weep. Like, mm-hmm. It just changed the whole conversation.
Yeah. You know, I think it's very important to understand that children who witness domestic violence have many of the same impacts as kids who are directly, physically, or sexually abused themselves in terms of the level of trauma that comes along with living in a house that is chaotic and violent and, aimed at power and control over their mother or their father. It's very, very damaging to kids, and not just because it's teaching them that that's how relationships are, but because they also have physical and somatic complaints. They are more likely to use drugs or alcohol, to commit suicide, to do poorly in school, and on and on.
Across the board.
Across the board.
Kids from violent and abusive homes do worse.
They do worse. They do a lot worse. And victims are strong people who are surviving every day. And I want to say that because I believe people who are staying in relationships that are harmful are not doing so to damage their kids. They're doing so to keep their kids safe. They think that, again, there could be a custody issue. And they're doing a lot of things in the moment that abuse is happening to get the kids upstairs or to a neighbor's or to minimize the impact. And that's great and important. They're surviving on a daily basis. But the kids are impacted, and they are certainly being damaged by witnessing the abuse. And they know a whole lot more than you think they do. Because once a kid starts talking about it, often moms are like, how did they even know they were asleep? And it's like, no, they were just quiet. And they absorbed a lot of it.
It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
So my next question goes along with this email. Then I guess I'll go ahead and read the email first. My adult daughter has been in a verbally abusive marriage for 13 years. My son-in-law denies that he is abusive. There is a 9-year-old daughter in the family. I fear for what she is learning about how she should be treated by a husband. My daughter will not think of leaving because she is afraid the courts will award the father partial custody, leaving the daughter to be exposed to abuse of her own. If you have a family member who is involved in some of this, how do you reach out and help them? How do you get to them because I'm sure many people have tried, just leave them. I mean, that's not that simple. How do you help that person?
Yeah, I think the most important rule when you're intervening with someone is to do so non-judgmentally and without exhibiting your own controlling behaviors. So don't tell the person what they should do.
Right.
Offer them lots of options and resources. And the most important thing you can tell someone is that you love them and you're concerned about them. And no matter what their choices are, you're going to be there. You don't want to remove your support in terms of, a sort of damaged thought process that you might convince them to leave their 13-year marriage if you stop talking to them. That won't work. Keep your support there. Let them know that if they need you or if they're unsafe, you're available. Give them a crisis line number. Tell them you love them. You can have conversations about how you're worried about the impact on their kids, but I would do so in a very planful and careful way so that you don't come across as judging them, because it's a very complex issue, and they're probably doing the best they can in that moment. And so just stick with it. And I know it's extremely frustrating for friends and family because you feel like you're watching someone sort of on this path of destruction.
It's awful.
It is awful. And it's something we're here for. So know that AWAKE often talks with family members and friends and kind of just offers a listening ear and some emotional support and ideas. But there's nothing you can do to make someone leave. And intervening in ways that sort of get on the abuser's radar can actually make that person more unsafe. Right. So if your instinct is to go and kind of confront him and that kind of a thing, just be very careful and know there could be some unintended consequences.
That would be my instinct if somebody was hurting one of my daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I'll go deal with that.
Yeah. And it's a lot of people's instinct, and it makes sense because you're angry. You're seeing someone hurting a loved one, but you could do that and have that, few minutes of satisfaction during that confrontation, and then that person's going to go and probably hurt the victim more. It's going to escalate things. So my best advice is to tell them you love them, tell them it's not their fault, and offer them a lot of options and resources and empathy.
So you said that domestic violence and aggression is not about anger. It's not about, it's about power and control.
Right.
But isn't it also underneath the power and control, isn't it really about insecurity and fear?
Well, often abusers are very insecure, and you know, they may have a fear of losing that person in that relationship, and they've learned that the way to be secure and the way to not be afraid is to have ultimate control over everything that their partner does.
Comes back to control.
Right. It keeps coming back to control. I just think it's so important to understand that. It's exerting power, and it's all about control.
So, real quickly, can you tell us about, you mentioned something that you wanted to talk about, the Green Dot program that's going to be sort of launched here coming up in April. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
So if you think about a crime map with all the little red dots that show each individual act of rape and domestic violence that's happening.
Like at a police station?
In our community, like at a police station. That's the visual. And each of those acts are one individual making a choice in a moment. And what we know is that there are more people in Alaska who don't want the next act of domestic violence to happen and who don't want the next rape to happen than there are abusive people. We outnumber them. This problem can seem overwhelming when you think about, wow, 50% of the women in Anchorage have experienced domestic violence or sexual assault.
That's a crazy number.
9,070 women last year have experienced domestic violence, wow, or sexual assault just in Anchorage. It can feel insurmountable. But what we know for sure about culture change is we just need to outnumber those red dots. And so the Green Dot program basically says we need to change our culture to make it a place where violence will not be tolerated and that everyone is expected to do their part. And that means that you're expected to intervene if you see warning signs that abuse is about to happen. For example, if you're in the store and you see a couple fighting, you're expected to do something. And we know that there's reasons why people aren't. They may be afraid to get involved. They may have learned that you shouldn't talk about this issue. They may think it's none of their business. And the Green Dot program says those reasons you have are okay. Those barriers are fine. And what we need to do is give you some other options. So if you're too shy to go and confront an issue directly, you can do something else. You could delegate it to the store manager. You could delegate it to the police. You could distract by dropping a jar of pickles and making a scene that sort of just interrupts what's happening.
Something to draw
attention away from it.
Yeah.
The idea is you don't have to go through a personal journey of change to make yourself more assertive to go confront something. You can do a lot of different things to interrupt that abusive incident. Those are called reactive green dots.
Uh-huh.
It's stopping violence that's about to happen. The other kind of green dot is called proactive, and that's what's going to change our culture. It's each of us every day doing something to, again, make the people around us know that violence is not tolerated and that we expect them to do their part. For me, in my personal life, I have started having conversations with friends and family. No, I don't just need you to come to an awake event. I need you to let the people around you know that violence is not okay and they need to get involved.
All right. I guess that is the last word. Let's see. Where's my spot? My thanks to today's guest, Melissa Immel, Deputy Director at Awake. It was a pleasure and education having you here today. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSK on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, I will be back to discuss gratitude, positive thinking, and the art of change with returning guest, Anchorage psychologist Dr. Jennifer Beef. So why not tune in to Your Health and learn more Monday, March 17th from 2 to 3 p.m., repeating that same evening at 9 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Until next week, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.